as we opened 1 Kings chapter 8 last time, we witnessed the turning of a cosmic page in redemption history, and thus in Israel's history. And this is because Israel is the context through which God chose to bring about redemption on earth. The temple was completed, it was about to be consecrated into service, and although it would be a few more years before Solomon's personal palace would be completed, it was under construction. Alfred Edersheim, that brilliant, insightful 19th century Jewish believer whose thoughts and writings so heavily influences much of today's Jewish Roots movement, makes the observation that the two dwelling complexes, the one for God, the one for the king, the temple and the palace, constructed on the Temple Mount, were far from ordinary. The temple and the palace together had extraordinary symbolism that not only showed an organic connection between the two of them, but also this new reality of their very existence marked the end of the time of Israel being in an unsettled condition. Now, until now, what passed for priestly services over the past 300-400 years was performed in the remnants of a tent called the Mishkan in Hebrew. Now, we know of this place as the Wilderness Tabernacle. It was originally designed to be a mobile sanctuary for Jehovah as Israel wandered and sought not only a permanent place of rest for the Hebrew people, but also a permanent place where God would choose to set his holy name over it forever. And that place turned out to be Yerushalayim in the land of Canaan, in the tribal territory of Judah. And the combination of land and sanctuary is what the Bible calls the kingdom of God. Now, God also demonstrated that he would govern and administer justice over his earthly kingdom by means of an earthly king. And at the beginning of the book of Judges, I made the claim that despite the nearly universal teaching within the church that God did not want his people to have a king, that God was to be acknowledged as Israel's only sovereign, in fact, that's a mistaken belief. The Holy Scriptures make it crystal clear that part of the purpose of the period of the Shoftim, the judges, was so that Israel would finally grasp that they could not function as intended without a king. The issue was never king or no king. The issue was what kind of king Israel was to have. Who would appoint him? So we see in the model and the pattern of the theocracy that was now Israel under King Shlomo that the anointed earthly king over God's kingdom was not to be a monarch in the typical Middle Eastern or Oriental or even then later European sense of it. That is, the earthly king over Israel was not to be seen as an autonomous dictatorial figure who would claim to be a kind of a vice king, with the God of Israel being the higher king, but rather, Israel's king was to be God's servant, set over Israel merely to carry out God's will. And God's will was that his covenants with Israel, which were the immutable documents that set out the terms and conditions for redemption of humanity using Israel as its earthly instrument, they were to be carefully guarded. They were to be carried out by Israel's king at God's direction. This is why the construction of Solomon's palace immediately adjacent to the temple was necessary, in order to illustrate this special arrangement and connectedness between God and king. Now, in our last meeting, we also discussed the timing of the dedication of Solomon's temple, and we noticed two things. First, there was a very practical reason for the ceremony to happen in the seventh month of the religious calendar year. It was that on the 10th day of that month, Yom Kippur occurred. And on this auspicious day alone could anyone enter into the Holy of Holies. And the only authorized person that could do that was the high priest. And since the Holy of Holies, and therefore the temple, only became operable when the ark could be placed into that innermost chamber of the Hekal, the temple proper. And no doubt more than the high priest then had to enter the Holy of Holies on this one occasion. Because if I'm right that this was when the ark was first set into place, then other priests would have been needed to carry that heavy box in there and place it. The second thing we noticed was that 5 days following Yom Kippur was the first day of the 7 day, or technically 8 day, Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot. And this feast also played a vital role in the temple dedication process. Well, we read the entire chapter 8, and it was a long chapter. And we're going to reread parts of this chapter now in bite-sized chunks. So, turn your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 8. We're going to reread the first 21 verses only. And that's on page 377 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. 377. 1 Kings chapter 8, we're going to read the first 21 verses. Then Shlomo, Solomon, assembled all the leaders of Israel, all the heads of the tribes and the chiefs of the paternal clans of the people of Israel, to King Shlomo in Jerusalem, to bring the ark for the covenant of Adonai out of the city of David, also known as Zion. All the men of Israel assembled before King Solomon at the festival in the month of Etanim, the seventh month. All the leaders of Israel came. The Kohanim, the priests, took the ark, and they brought up the ark of Adonai, the tent of meeting, and all the holy utensils that were in the tent. These are what the priests and the Levites brought up. Now King Shlomo and the whole community of Israel assembled in his presence, were with him in front of the ark, sacrificing sheep and oxen in numbers beyond counting or recording. The priests brought the ark for the covenant of Adonai to its place inside the sanctuary of the house, to the especially holy place, under the wings of the Karuvim, the cherubim. For the Karuvim spread out their wings over the place for the ark, covering the ark and its poles from above. Now the poles were so long that their ends could be seen from the holy place in front of the sanctuary, but they could not be seen from the outside. They are there to this day. There was nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone which Moses put there at Horeb, which Adonai made the covenant with the people of Israel at the time of their leaving the land of Egypt. And when the Kohanim came out of the holy place, the cloud filled the house of Adonai, so that because of the cloud, the priests couldn't stand up to perform their service. For the glory of Adonai filled the house of Adonai. Shlomo said, Adonai said he would live in thick darkness, but I have built you a magnificent house, a place where you can live forever. Then the king turned around and blessed the whole community of Israel. The whole community of Israel stood as he said, Blessed be Adonai, the God of Israel, who spoke to my father David with his mouth and fulfilled his promise with his hand. And he said, Since the day I brought my people Israel out of Egypt, I chose no city from any of the tribes of Israel in which to build a house, so that my name might be there. But I did choose David to be over my people Israel. Now it was in the heart of David my father to build a house for the name of Adonai the God of Israel. But Adonai said to David my father, Although it was in your heart to build a house for my name, and you did well that it was in your heart, nevertheless you will not build the house. Rather you will father a son, it will be he who will build the house for my name. Now Adonai has fulfilled this spoken word of his. For I have succeeded my father, and I sit on the throne of Israel, as Adonai promised. And I've built the house for the name of Adonai, the God of Israel. And there I have made a place for the ark containing the covenant of Adonai, which he made with our ancestors when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. In this chapter, we're going to encounter some of the most profound God principles concentrated into a single place that rivals any in the Bible. And some of these God principles are of the kind that defies adequate human explanation by means of mere words. And yet, when we take the time to look at them closely, we're still left slack-jawed in awe and wonder. So we're going to take our time. We're going to extract as much as we can from these passages, so great is their value. Now, verse 1 explains just who was invited to Jerusalem for these festivities. Now, it's best if we look at the Hebrew words as they're translated somewhat differently by the various English Bible versions. It says that the Zachen, the Rosh, the Nasi, all of these were invited. Zaken literally means old, and it means old ones, or as we say today, elders. These were the people's representatives, usually the senior citizens, if you would, of Israel, who were not hereditary tribal leaders. They weren't aristocrats either. So Rosh means head. This category is referring to the heads of the families and of the clans of Israel. Finally, the Nasi are the 12 tribal princes of Israel. And these 12 tribal princes, they inherited their positions. So what is being described by Zachen, Rosh, and Nasi were the three major categories of dignitaries of Israel. In verse 2, however, we're told that all the Ish of Israel were assembled before King Shlomo. Ish means men, males, in a very general way. Now, there are some scholars who say that this is referring to the army, or that it's merely throwing all the Zachen, Rosh, and Nasi into one big bucket, and together calling them the Ish of Israel. Now, I think it's self-evident that's not the case. All one needs to know is the Torah, and that issue just disappears. The information that this was occurring in the seventh month, and then later on in verses 65 and 66 in this chapter, we're told that there was a seven-day celebration immediately followed by another seven-day celebration that actually included an eighth day, makes it clear that this second celebration was really Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. And the Feast of Tabernacles is a chag. It is a pilgrimage festival that requires all adult males in Israel, regardless of social status, to journey to the temple. Therefore, all we have is that in the first verse, we're told that all these dignitaries were present. And in the second verse, all the adult males of Israel were also present. All classes of society then were drawn to the temple dedication, and they stayed after it for the Feast of Tabernacles. In a reality, the dedication and the feast were intentionally held at the same time so they could be celebrated together. Now, one of the items brought to the temple was the tent of meeting. In Hebrew, Oel Moed. It also went by the name of Mishkan. Now, this is not the special tent that David made for the Ark of the Covenant and placed it in the old city of David. Rather, this is the remnant of the wilderness tabernacle that had been resting in Gibeon up until now. And it, along with the location of Gibeon, was essentially being officially decommissioned as the authorized place of sacrifice and worship. What it must have looked like at this point is anyone's guess, but there couldn't have been much left of the original, if anything at all, since at least 400 years had passed since it was first assembled out in the wilderness during the Exodus from Egypt. Now, it's interesting that verse 5 speaks of the priests bringing the ark to the temple grounds, and that King Solomon and the whole community of Israel were in front of it making countless sacrifices. Then in verse 6, it says that the priests brought the ark inside the sanctuary. Now, first of all, notice it says the priests transported the ark. That doesn't seem to be according to the Torah law. It was the clan of Kohath. You find this in Numbers 7:9. Common Levites, who were not priests, who were the only people authorized to carry the ark. The Hebrew sages say the reason for this change was that it was only during the wilderness wanderings that the Levite clan of Kohath was given this honor. And once a temple was built, well, then that privilege ended. And while there's no such scriptural statement to that effect, I can easily see the sages' logic in their conclusion. After all, theoretically, once there's a permanent temple, there's no more need to be transporting that ark around. Its journey's over. Once ensconced in the Holy of Holies, it ought to never be moved again. But also notice that first, all Israel assembled, and then they sacrificed in front of the ark, and then next it was moved into the temple. Therefore, what happened is pretty easy to timeline. On the eighth day of Tishri, which is the Hebrew name for the seventh month, the ceremonies began with a procession that brought the Ark of the Covenant from its special tent in the city of David up to the Temple Mount. On the eighth and the ninth days of the month, the Ark sat in the courtyard and a huge amount of sacrifices were made in front of it. It was fine for the Ark to be sitting there as a kind of witness to the proceedings as long as it was covered, which no doubt it was. And the actual golden ark couldn't be seen by the people. Now, on the 10th day of the month, which is what? Yom Kippur, the ark was moved in to the temple by priests, just a few feet, and placed in the front room, least holy chamber inside the temple. And then it was carried further inside the temple to the Holy of Holies and set down under the wings of those cherubim. Now, what happens for the remainder of this chapter then occurred from the 10th day through the 14th day of Tishri. The 8th through the 14th is the 7-day temple dedication festival that's spoken of in verse 65. Then on the 15th day of Tishri began the biblical festival of what? Sukkot, Feast of Tabernacles, which lasted then for 8 days through the 22nd of the month. On the 23rd day of the seventh month, then the people began filtering back home after what would probably have proven to be the most memorable 2 weeks of their lives. Now, verse 9 makes a statement that has caused needless controversy, although it is more controversial for Christians than Jews. Because there it says explicitly that the only items inside that golden chest that was the ark were the stone tablets from Mount Sinai. Most Christian scholars dispute that statement as an error because they favor the New Testament book of Hebrews in chapter 9, verse 4, where it says that inside the ark, along with the stone tablets, were a pot of manna and Aaron's budding staff. Thus, it has been a standard Christian teaching that the tablets of the law, some manna, and the staff were always inside of the ark. However, Jews have never believed that. You know why? It's not what the Torah says. Rather, in Numbers 17:25, we're told that Aaron's staff was set not in the ark, but before the ark. Frankly, Exodus 16:33-34, by the way, we're told that the pot of manna was also set before the ark, not in the ark. And this is one of the many reasons, that the book of Hebrews has been held suspect since sometime when the earlier church fathers argued over whether it even ought to be included as part of the New Testament. As a matter of fact, about half of all Christian denominations do not have the book of Hebrews in their Bibles. And it's been taken over the centuries. The book of Hebrews has been added, removed, added back in again, time after time after time. So to our day, there's only some Christian denominations that accept the book of Hebrews as a legitimate part of the New Testament. Now in verse 10, a most awesome thing happens. The cloud that marks the presence of the Lord suddenly appears and it fills the temple. The cloud was so luminous that its presence felt as though it was pressing down with an irresistible pressure, and it forced the priests to leave. There is nothing to indicate that Solomon or the priests were expecting this. On the other hand, it must have been very welcomed, especially by the king. After all, King Solomon had spent years of effort and enormous sums of other people's money on this house for the Lord. What if Jehovah didn't accept it? But with the appearance of the cloud, not only did Solomon and everyone who was there have validated that the Lord could dwell there, but this was the real consecration of the facility that was beyond man-made ceremonies. To consecrate means to set something apart for God. To set apart means to make something holy. Only God makes holy. Only God. Only God declares what's holy. Man can't confer or declare holiness on anyone or anything. That's the sole province of the Lord. And so the appearance of the cloud in the temple conferred holiness onto that newly built structure. Now, verse 11 says that the cloud was the glory of Yehovah. In Hebrew, the word is kavod. And we can get a little bit too rigid in assigning the word glory as the meaning of kavod in all instances. It more means abundant presence. Then verse 12 has Solomon saying that although the Lord said that he would live in a thick cloud, now that a house has been built for Jehovah, this would become his dwelling place. This sentence has some very interesting nuances hidden within it, most of it revolving around the word cloud. Now, there are several Hebrew words that mean cloud, but each of them means something slightly different. The one used here is arfel, arfel. Now, many translations, as does our complete Jewish Bible, translate arfel to thick darkness, when it really ought to say thick cloud. And I think while that isn't necessarily wrong, it can give us the wrong impression. For one thing, the English word darkness, especially when we find it in the Bible, usually carries an evil or fearful overtone with it. And on a number of occasions, we've looked at a typical Hebrew word for darkness, which is choshech, and learned that it is indeed meant to convey to us something that involves an evil darkness, and thus a frightening spiritual nature to it. But the word choshek isn't used here. The word is arafel. So a much better translation of arafel in modern English would be a dense cloud. Something that's so thick, it completely obscures whatever is in it or above it. And I will tell you, if you've ever been to the coast of California, I have been in an RFL many times to where you cannot see the hand, your hand in front of your face. The fog is so thick. So this is my mental picture of what this must have been like. Well, this dense cloud, you see, is meant to act as a covering and a barrier. So the cloud that appeared in the temple wasn't meant to inspire terror. It was meant to bring about an awesome reverence. And when we often hear of God appearing in a cloud, like the one that was with Israel all through the wilderness, when Christ ascended, for instance, it was no cheap phrase to say that he rose up into the clouds. And then what happened, does it say? He became obscured by them. So the idea of calling whatever this presence of God is in the temple a cloud is to try and describe some kind of an indeterminate form. We can certainly look up and see a cloud, but we can't really touch it. And you know what? We can't even assign it a definite shape. I mean, for a moment, it might remind us of something familiar, but in another moment, that cloud's gone, or its form has shifted to something else. In the end, using the term cloud to describe this particular presence of God is just a means to find a term to describe the indescribable. And this goes hand in hand with God refusing to allow manufactured images of him. Because unlike all the false gods populating the world's societies that are either fashioned from humans or animals, Yahweh bears no form whatsoever that could be captured or properly defined in human terms or even as something familiar within this four-dimensional universe that we all live. Solomon ends his thought about the temple being God's dwelling place on earth by saying that it will be Yahweh's dwelling place forever. But we need to pause and understand something that's critical to our understanding of God. The temple is but a conduit of sorts between man and God. It's just a place. It's a means whereby God meets man in fellowship for man's benefit, and communication takes place. So the idea that the temple is a place for God to dwell forever doesn't mean the temple as an earthly visible form that's made out of wood and stone, but rather this forever habitation is speaking of the ultimate divine substance that is God and is indicative of his presence with his people. The earthly form, in this case Solomon's temple, it's going to change over time. It's going to decay. But the divine substance that inhabits it and that it consecrates the building and it makes it a temple, that never changes. So it is the substance of God that is forever, not some earthly form of habitation and meeting. Now, for a while, God's substance was present in this world in a number of forms. A cloud, the angel of the Lord, the Shekinah, the Ruach, even the glory, the Kavod of God. Then with the advent of Yeshua, God's substance was present on earth for a while in human form. Then, after Christ, God's substance was made present in this world inside of humans. And we call this the Holy Spirit. And later in the future, God's substance will again be with mankind in the form of Yeshua returning as our king. The form keeps changing. The substance never does. It's rightly said in the modern church that the fleshly bodies of believers amount to God's temples in this era. The substance of God that dwells in us is never ending, never changing. But guess what? These imperfect fleshly temples do a lot of change and decaying. I was just looking at some of my youth pictures the other day, and this one's changed a lot. Further, just as God's presence in Solomon's temple is what consecrated it, it's what made it holy, so it is that God's presence in his worshipers consecrates us. Whatever holiness there is in us, it's that. We can adorn ourselves with the finest garments, wear the most beautiful and expensive religious icons. We can say all the right things and completely look the part. But unless God actually dwells in us, we possess no saving holiness at all. We just look good. We're just empty shells. It matters not whether we are as tattered, beaten down, or used up tents, or as magnificent, shining new edifices. It is God's presence that makes holy. And God's presence has no interest. It has no respect for outward grandness or plainness of his temples, whether made of building materials or flesh. At this point in verse 14, the king turned from facing the temple, and he said a blessing over the crowds of people that were there. And he pronounces that the promise made to David, his father, by the Lord has now been fulfilled. He also reminds the people that nowhere in the Torah did God inform his people in what city he would choose to put his name, meaning to permit a temple to be built in his name for him. However, David was chosen of God, and in a sense, David chose what city that temple would be built in. Yet David would not get to build the building. That honor would go to his son. Shlomo was that son. He's now king. The temple has been built. All of God's promises in this regard have now been brought to reality. With that, let's read a little bit more in 1 Kings. Let's start at chapter 8, 22. And we're just going to read a few verses to verse 30. Starting at verse 22. Then Shlomo stood before the altar of Adonai in the presence of the whole community of Israel and spread out his hands towards heaven and said, Adonai, God of Israel, there's no God like you in heaven above or on earth below. You keep covenant with your servants and show them grace, provided they live in your presence with all their heart. You have kept your promise to your servant David, my father. You spoke with your mouth. You fulfilled it with your hand. So it is today. Now, therefore, Adonai, God of Israel, keep what you promised to your servant David, my father, when you said, you will never lack a man in my presence to sit on the throne of Israel if only your children are careful about what they do so that they live in my presence just as you've lived in my presence. Now, therefore, God of Israel, please let your word, which you spoke to your servant David, my father, be confirmed. But can God actually live on earth? Why, heaven itself, even the heaven of heavens, can't contain you. So how much less this house I have built? Even so, Adonai, my God, pay attention to your servant's prayer and plea. Listen to the cry and prayer that your servant is praying before you today, that your eyes will be open towards this house night and day, towards the place concerning which you said, my name will be there. to listen to the prayer your servant will pray towards this place. Yes, listen to the plea of your servant and also that of your people, Israel, when they pray towards this place. Hear in heaven where you live. And when you hear, forgive. This begins now a long and moving prayer that really can't be rivaled in the entire Bible except by the one spoken by Yeshua that we call the Lord's Prayer. Verse 22 begins by saying that Solomon stood before the altar, before the congregation of Israel. He ascended the steps of the altar of burnt offering, and then he went to his knees. We don't see this act of kneeling here in 1 Kings chapter 8, but we do find it in the parallel account of this event in 2 Chronicles. In 2 Chronicles 6, 12 and 13, then he stood before the altar of Adonai in the presence of the whole community of Israel, and he spread out his hands. For Shlomo had made a bronze platform, 8 3/4 feet long, 8 3/4 feet wide, and 5 1/4 feet high, and had it set up in the middle of the courtyard. He stood on it, then he got down on his knees before the whole community and spread out his hands towards heaven. Depending on your English translation, the opening words of Solomon's prayer that begins in chapter 8, verse 23, goes something like this. God of Israel, there is no God like you in heaven or on earth below. You keep covenant with your servants. You show them grace, provided they live in your presence with all their heart. There's a great deal here, and we're going to, and one way to peel the layers back a bit is to insert or reinsert some of the original Hebrew words. Yehovah Elohim of Israel. There is Lo Elohim like you in Shamayim or on Eretz. You keep Berit and Chesed with your servants, provided they live in your presence with all of their life. Solomon invokes God's formal name, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Yehovah. And he acknowledges that he is Israel's God. There's no God comparable to him in the spiritual sphere of heaven, Shamayim, or on the physical sphere of the land, the Eretz. He says that Yehovah continues to honor the covenants, the Berit, that he's made with his people and continues to show them loving kindness, chesed. And then Solomon's prayerful statement adds a caveat. The maintaining of all these wonderful covenants and the loving kindness with his nation of Israel is conditional. It's conditional on them living in his presence with all of their consciousness. As I've mentioned on numerous occasions, the Hebrew word that we find here, lev, does indeed literally mean heart. However, all throughout Old Testament and New Testament times, the heart was thought to be the seat of intellect, of consciousness. That is, that the heart possessed all those functions that we now know is performed by our brains. So whereas modern Christianity has turned the word heart into something that has to do with feelings and emotions, in fact, the sense of the word was always referring to conscious thoughts and the resultant behaviors and actions. Thus, God will only show, we're told, his loving kindness to Israel and bestow the blessings contained within these covenants to the nation of Israel, provided they obey him and they walk in his ways. Cease doing so, blessings are yanked. God's kindness turns to strong discipline. We have an almost exact parallel to this thought in the New Testament, and it's going to sound familiar to you. In Romans 11, 16 through 22, we hear this. Now, if the challah offered as first fruits is holy, so is the whole loaf. And if the root is holy, so are the branches. But if some of the branches were broken off, and you, a wild olive tree, speaking of Gentiles, you, a wild olive tree, were grafted in among them, and have you've become rich, you become equal sharers in the rich root of the olive tree, then don't boast, as if you are better than the branches. However, if you do boast, remember that you aren't supporting the root. The root's supporting you. So you'll say, so branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. True, but so what? They were broken off because of their lack of trust. However, you keep your place only because of your trust. So don't be arrogant. On the contrary, be terrified. Because if God didn't spare the natural branches, he's certainly not going to spare you. So take a good look at God's kindness and his severity. On the one hand, severity towards those who fell off. But on the other hand, God's kindness towards you, provided you maintain yourself in that kindness, otherwise you too will be cut off. Pretty straightforward. One has to believe that St. Paul had Solomon's prayer in mind when he spoke these words to a group of Gentiles in Rome. God's kindness towards his redeemed is conditional, based on maintaining oneself in a manner that continues to merit that kindness. And what is it that merits that kindness? Trust. Full devotion to the Lord. And how is trust in him demonstrated? By putting it into action through obedience to his commandments. It's that simple. Now, someone will, of course, say, now, wait a minute. I thought in our era, showing trust in God was accomplished by showing trust in Messiah. And that's true on one level. St. Paul is here talking to believers. He's talking to people who've already put their trust in Yeshua. He's not talking to others. He's talking to believers. He is addressing those who've already been grafted in. He's not talking to seekers who might want to be. He's talking to believers. So this entire section of Romans 11 only applies to those who are already redeemed in Christ. In the same way that Solomon's prayer applied only to the redeemed of Israel. So this blessing of Solomon's is also a not-so-veiled threat, just like Paul's is. Solomon then asked the Lord to keep a prophetic promise that can only play out over centuries, that Yahweh would maintain a descendant of King David on the throne of Israel at all times. But that did not mean that a descendant of David who was doing wrong might not be removed. And oh, many were. Solomon had many children. So his children set up a number of family branches. All of them could legitimately state claim as a blood descendant of King David. So there would be a number of men legally eligible to take the throne over the coming centuries. God's promise wasn't limited to only one specific descendant. Verse 27 then opens up a conundrum that every thinking Christian wrestles with on a regular basis. Solomon says, God, you know, on the one hand, you dwell in the temple up on Mount Moriah. Yet on the other hand, you live in heaven. In fact, in reality, to think about you dwelling in a temple in heaven misses the mark. Because you are so magnificent and limitless that even heaven can't be sufficient to hold you. So how exactly, O Lord, Am I to understand your dwelling in this temple in Jerusalem when this cannot be the case in the way that a human being can conceptualize it? Now, there's some God principles alluded to here that I just want to touch on. And the first is the idea of omnipresence. Solomon recognizes that God is not a man who, because of being trapped in a physical body and a physical sphere of space-time, can only be in one place at one time. God is everywhere at once. God doesn't pack his bags, travel down from heaven to visit the temple on occasion, essentially vacating his throne in heaven for a time. It's like with his believers. God is quite literally present with us, dwelling in us, and yet the us are millions spread all over this planet, each having as much of God in us as any other. Even more, we know that he lives in heaven, and even the Lord's Prayer makes it clear, our Father who art in heaven, Christ was God on earth for a time. Does that mean God moved? If God relocated to earth, then who was Christ praying to all that time? Did a part of God come down to earth and become Yeshua, so only a partial God remained in heaven? See, it's this kind of thought process that Solomon is expressing as he speaks to Yahweh. Lord, I know you're present. Goodness, your cloud of glory just chased my priests right out of the temple. I just don't understand how you're present, what it all means. But all that said, you have told me, Lord, unequivocally, that you'll dwell in this temple. So despite my inability to comprehend how this can be, why you would even agree to live in such a lowly structure, I accept that it's true. Therefore, Solomon says that based on faith and trust, not with his own understanding, he's going to direct his prayers and the prayers of his people Israel towards that temple, that conduit of communication and fellowship between man and God. And despite his ignorance in verse 28, all that Solomon asks is that God would choose to hear the prayers of his servant. The word used for asking God to hear is one we've talked about before, Shema. It means not to just passively listen and to commiserate. It means to act. I'm going to close with this thought. We don't have to understand how, even why, God has chosen to dwell in these corrupt temples that we call our bodies. We don't have to question or understand how he can be present with all believers, everywhere, simultaneously, and be in heaven or anywhere else he chooses as well. Rather, we merely use these fleshly temples as the place from which we direct our prayers to him. We use these as a place of meeting, of fellowship between us and God. Not because we chose it to be like this. Not because we're able on our own to make it like this. Because the Lord chose to do it this way. Now, we just have to believe in him. And we have to act upon that belief. We're going to continue chapter 8 next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.